The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp. Let's take a
hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wisp, number 131. We always give Mike trouble for starting the exact same way, but I start precisely the same way every single time. So having said that, hello, Mike Hammett from Chicagoland.
How's it going?
I need to make that my ringtone for you. Not that you call me very often, but I like it. How's it going? How's it going? Nikki.
I do call you from time to time.
You do.
I should call you more. I should call you more.
Yeah, yeah. You usually call to tell me how bad my fashion sense is. You didn't like the way I was dressed the other day. Oh, man. Right after Labor Day, those sorts of rules. I always lose track. I really appreciate you keeping me on task.
That's impressive.
And that was Nick Arellano from not Chicagoland.
South of Chicagoland.
Gotcha. You're the burbs.
Hi,
the
everybody.
Burb kind of kid. Hello, everybody.
If there's me.
All right, that was for our international listeners. I'm sure you're going to love our accents. Fantastic. All right, so let's do the thing. We've got some new patrons this go around. And that is, you go to patreon.com/brotherswisp. You throw us a couple of, I always say bones, but maybe that doesn't always translate, internationally. You throw us some euros or rubles or dollars or whatever it happens to be. You make it rain, basically. And then you get access to our patron-only Slack. And this go around, we have a couple of new ones. We have Carl Kloppenborg and Ian Wells. One of those names was much easier for me to pronounce. They are both, however, Australian. We have so many Australians now that we created an Aussie channel, and it is lousy with them. They're all over the place in there. There's not an R to be found in the single message in there. You ever notice that Australians always like shark? It's not a shark. It's a shock. Somehow it gets. And then every other word they have to shorten. Like, what is it? Like breakfast is brekkie. And you don't go to the liquor store, you go to the bottle-o. And afternoon drinks, they call it Arvo. I guess you just make everything end in an O or an IE, and you're good. I don't know. I don't know why they really
have to write that
shorten
down.
Everything in such interesting ways, but I like it. I dig it. It's cute. Anyway, I digress. Let's also talk about our sponsors. We have a few sponsors that are helping us make this thing happen. So one is Sonar. Sonar is a scalable, intuitive, and comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. We actually talked to them not so long ago. So if you want to take a look at these cats, go over to sonar.software. You are their ideal customer. We had a conversation, and if you pay your bill, you're an ideal customer. So go pop over there and take a look at them. All right, who's reading the next one?
Nick. I guess I could do... Oh, all right, Nick. Nick, you were volunteered. Go ahead.
All right, I'll do tower coverage. So tower coverage is another sponsor. It's an RF propagation system to empower your network. Provides real-time data metrics to enable your coverage area, reaching your customer base, and more. So if you're not using RF propagation software, what are you doing with your network?
Not only that, what are you doing with your life?
Oh, how are you exactly living? It's just a guess.
Well, I suppose we're getting a lot more fiber operators, so I guess that we really didn't have much of a use for RF propagation, but tower coverage was adding some fiber-friendly features at one point.
Yeah, last time I logged in, I saw fiber stuff, so haven't used it yet, but it's in the sidebar.
It's the wave of the future. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it, but yeah, fiber to the X. It's getting hot. It's getting cool. Which is, counterintuitive because you wouldn't think I'd be doing both of those simultaneously, but it is. All right, Mikey, what's with the QuickBit stuff?
Let's see here. QuickBooks. No, not QuickBooks.
Without a sponsor yet.
I think I would deny QuickBooks being a sponsor. They have such terrible software. QuickBit. Indoor and outdoor 60 gigahertz gear that is just set it and forget it simple. Crazy feature set for the price with API, deployment tools, solid distance, and up to 8 clients per hub. The K60C is on the site now. But is the shopping cart on the site now?
I don't know.
That's the question.
Take a look. Take a look while I do the drum roll. That is kwikbit.com, if you want to take a look at that. Is the store up yet, Mikey?
Well, the site's not loading for me, so. There we go. I have a contact sales button, so I'm guessing
not. No store yet. We'll have to sit here with bated breath waiting.
Get notified. Anxiously. Get notified. Contact sales, yeah.
And now you feel like a kid before Christmas. Can't wait for that store part to pop up. So pop up in a quick bit. Drop them an email if you're interested in the product, because I think that stuff is pretty boss. All right. Let's get into some of the stuff. The first thing I want to say is if you have not complained, if you had asked us about time-coded links on the videos, you now have Ollie, our resident Norwegian, right? Is he from Norway? Yeah.
Yeah.
To thank for that. So I guess, is Ollie the official Brothers With curator? Is that the right word for it? I was thinking archivist, but curator sounds better. Like he's at a museum or something.
He has done it, yes, officially for one podcast.
Oh, you don't want to give him a title yet. He's so stingy.
He's got to earn it.
Well, you know,
Mike's been hurt before.
You can't just, can't just hand those things out like they're candy.
Well, given some runtime, if he does well, what's the official title you're going to bestow upon him?
Oof. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that.
I like curator. Go with curator. It sounds good. It almost, I don't know. Zookeeper? Is that maybe a more fitting title?
Zookeeper.
Are we animals in a zoo?
Time wizard.
Time wizard. All right. Good. All right. So, Ollie, thank you. I know you're going to hear this. You're going to hear it at 2x speed with the captions on, so hopefully it like does your name correctly and all that stuff.
Maybe we should open up a contest. Submit to us what you think Ollie's title should be for the guy that that comes up with the timestamps for our YouTube videos.
All right, rock and roll.
I don't know what we'll give you, but I guess we'll just give you a virtual cookie. I already gave out one membership this week, so I'm cut off.
All right, Mike's going to give you a big kiss full on the lips. So there you are. To whoever wins. All right, so let's get into some of the equipment. This go around, I'm not sure if you guys... Nick said he's going to transform his whole network based on these MikroTik announcements. So hold your hats or hold on to your beanies in Nick's case. But let's see. MikroTik announced a couple of new products, although the Chateau sounds familiar. I think we had heard about that one before. Maybe saw the FCC filing or something because we had heard of it. Maybe it's been... I digress.
There's another Chateau. This is the Chateau 5G.
Oh, okay.
It's a newer... It's another
product.
Okay,
so that's why it sounds familiar. The Chateau 5G. Sounds like you should have a little flute of champagne.
At the Chateau?
Or maybe you've got some cognac in your glass when you're talking about this product. But it is... I don't know. It's a small form factor. I would say... What does that thing look like? It's about 8 inches wide, 6 inches tall, somewhere in the neighborhood. It's got two 4 and 5G built in, or 2.4 and 5 gigahertz radios built in. It's got 5 gigabit Ethernet ports, and obviously, as the name implies, it also does 5G, right? LTE 5G support.
Yet, I went to try to find more details on the 5G, and... Well, all I could find was the model number for their LTE modem, which isn't listed anywhere other than this data sheet. So I can't tell you what bands it supports. I know that their 4G ones finally started to have a whole bunch of bands. I know the earlier ones didn't. But I don't know what 5G band they support. There's a lot of
them. The LTE modem is R11, so I'm assuming that's one of theirs. Right? R11ML.
Yeah, I mean, that. Looking at the model number, it looks like a MikroTik.
Quad core, 716 megahertz, 256 megs of RAM. So it's a decent little box. You're not going to put it at your BGP border router, but it seems like a decent little piece of kit.
I haven't really done much with the MikroTik LTE stuff. I started to a while ago. Actually, not even using their own modem, using my own USB modem popped in, and then they weren't going to support. I don't remember what it was. Something until version 7. So I just kind of stopped working on that until then. There's something about getting a public IP directly on the device with the carrier I was wanting to use. I think that was a problem.
Yeah, that's a lot of them. I know Ting does that same thing. You get a private IP. So you have to have your piece of kit create a tunnel of some sort out to a concentrator, and then you can kind of backdoor into it that way, or at least that's the way I've had success with it. Looking at the data sheet, it says one router to delight them all.
That Chateau and champagne flute
delight me. Mm-hmm. It does. It pinkies up. That does delight me.
You can use the LTE modem. You can get a wireline provider plugged in, and you can get your Starlink all plugged in. There you go.
Solid, man. You're good to go.
And you still have a couple gig ports left over.
Yeah. And a full USB port, it looks like.
Full size USB. All right. Yeah. How about the MikroTik Knot, KNOT in all caps, IoT gateway for the most versatile and cost effective setups?
I've been really hoping for some sort of ecosystem around this stuff, like, that we could just deploy and serve people versus building it yourself. And I haven't heard of any, and I don't feel like building anything.
I was assuming this was going to be LoRaWAN, but is it not?
Yeah, I think it is another LoRaWAN product.
All right. I'm looking for it on the data sheet. I don't see the words. Show me the words. Because I see them talking about, it's got a slot for like a SIM card, right?
In the video they talked about LoRa.
Alright. Because it does have a SIM card slot, so I'm guessing it's got a modem in there where it's gonna dial out like LTE or something. Or am I crazy? What is this thing doing?
In the video, they're also talking about Cat-M, which is other sort of IoT-type technology.
It says Nearband or Cat-M. It's much cheaper than LTE. Why spend money on bandwidth you don't need?
I don't know if this is becoming increasingly common in their products or not, but I see that for the built-in GPS, they actually support 4 different constellations, GPS, GLONASS, which are pretty common, but then Baidu and Galileo.
So this has also got a Bluetooth interface for asset tracking and telemetry based on Bluetooth advertisement packets. So I guess you can pair something with this thing, like in a sensor, to be able to pull additional information, a couple of Ethernet ports, micro USB. And it looks like it's got a Modbus jack right on that. I'm assuming that's going to be Modbus RTU. Does this thing act as a Modbus TCP gateway, though? That'd be pretty neat if it did.
As I look through the data sheet, there's lots of references to things that if I knew what they were, it would probably be impressive. So you got, iBeacon, Eddystone. I'm guessing those are things in that space. Because in there, I do see references to, like, hospital management. You can slap some Bluetooth, tags on a bunch of devices, and then where they are when they're returned.
It says, you can use the Knot as a TCP bridge for wired Modbus sensors. So to me, that reads as This is a Modbus TCP gateway. So that's going to be a Modbus RTU interface, which is the standard serial Modbus protocol. And Modbus TCP allows you to use the Modbus TCP protocol to hit it like it's a regular Modbus device, but you're doing it over a TCP IP network. That's how I did all the BCM collection at the data center, so the branch circuit monitoring for power. I had a Modbus TCP gateway that ran to all the BCMs, and so I wrote a program that would pull those jokers every 5 minutes and then pull the data for all the circuits on the panel boards and pull that back in. So this would act as kind of a remote gateway. I guess you could just pop it straight off an Ethernet network, or what's interesting is, yeah, if you've got capabilities with a SIM card slot to use whatever that other NB or CAT-M protocol is. I've never used that stuff. I guess you could pop it into a network and do it that way as well. So that's interesting. Normally, the Modbus gateways usually range in the like $125 to $200 range. They're usually in that neighborhood. So if it's got that capability in there and it's reliable and it's in that power range, or rather in that price range, it's already a good deal for what you're getting if you're using it for that application, I would say. I haven't done enough IoT stuff to really be able to speak to any of the other features on there. It's interesting. I don't really, well, I mean, I guess I do know some people doing some collection stuff. It looks like their diagram, they're showing it in like a medical setting.
They're talking about agriculture, industrial IoT, logistics, smart parking, all kinds of different stuff. There you go. I'd be interested to see a full MikroTik or a gateway type solution to see what people are doing with these. There must be a market for it if they're making more products, so.
For sure.
Yeah, that's something I wish I knew more about. It's always like, I don't understand where the use is in it, but yeah, people keep talking about it and they keep making more of them, so.
Yeah.
I feel left out in that I don't know how it's being used.
We do so much petroleum, whether it's production, logistics, you know, like if you've got remote wells, there's a lot of things you're going to be doing sensors on. So a lot of those guys are using different data collection methods for that and then pulling it back in, right? And some people call it, they'll tie it into a SCADA system, or some people will just call it IoT. You know, they just kind of pick and choose what they want to, what kind of nomenclature they use. But that to me seems like one of the uses for LoRaWAN is you've got a field site with a lot of sensors you're pulling in information, you know, like that, like what's the valve position on this pipe? What's the pressure over here? How much fluid's in this tank? You know, is this motor running? You know, just basic stuff like that you want to pull together. So maybe that's kind of the market they're shooting for on that. Who knows?
Yeah, it looks like so if you look at the video that Thrift shared in the Slack group, they're using this platform called the Things Network. And there's a lot of different use cases on there, but it just looks like the LoRaWAN products. There's like a whole class of products that use some kind of UDP protocol to send this telemetry data. And this hooks up to something like the Things Network to relay all that data back to like a cloud managed dashboard that shows like all your real time metrics for all the stuff that's in the LoRa kit. So I'm interested to see what all there is, because there's some smart home mentioning stuff. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting.
I only usually see Modbus used in industrial applications. I've never seen it used in kind of the home networky sort of stuff. But when you're talking about LoRaWAN, I guess that could be any kind of sensor.
Yeah, because it's got 2.4 Bluetooth, you know, the Modbus stuff. I can forward stuff to MQTT, I guess, or HTTP. So it's probably some use cases. I'm just not too sure.
Interesting.
So I guess if people can point us to some other resources or have experience at this sort of thing versus us just reading websites and, hey, this must be what this does. I see that as I look and I see, public community network. Okay, there must be some sort of aspect out there where you build a network for other people to use. But, yeah, Give us comments. Tell us what the heck is going on.
Interesting. For sure. So while we're talking about MikroTik stuff, I saw it in the MikroTik channel, and we've seen this from time to time, and I just figured we'd say it out loud just for the folks that aren't in there, is that if you're using the MikroTik switches, like the CRS line, whatever it happens to be, one of the things you want to look for maximum throughput is to make sure that hardware is on. So hardware forwarding, right? So you've got those switching ASICs, the application-specific integrated circuits built in, and the more of those you can utilize with your switching, the better you're going to be. You definitely don't want to try and run real bandwidth through the CPU. That you're going to have a bad time. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Yes. It's very, very noticeable.
I remember back when the CRS series came out, it was like every other post on Facebook was, you know, I can't get more than 20 megs through my new, you know, 48 port. I guess they didn't 40 port, you know, new 24 port gig MikroTik router. It's like, well, it's not a router, it's a switch. You know, mm-hmm. You have the whole conversation every time.
Yeah, but they put an R right in there. It's like cloud router switch, right? Isn't that what that stands for?
It's definitely confusing. Yeah, that's what it stands for.
It certainly doesn't help.
Maybe it should stand for could route, but just switch. Something like that. It's really good.
Or
for
can't switch. Route. It's a switch.
There you go.
That's what it should be.
Well, it's not that it can't. It can do it. It's just not going to do a great job.
Shouldn't.
Of it, so, yeah. Okay. So, be sure that that your stuff has the hardware forwarding on if absolutely possible. So, something that happened, it was last week, right? That thing kind of came and went, was the snowpocalypse. And I guess, was it only as the snowpocalypse for Texas? I mean, I know it hit everybody and everybody got snow, but I don't think anybody had as much fun as Texas did they?
I think Texas just had unique circumstances.
You guys are special down there. We were snowflakes, individuals. Yeah, so I live in Texas, and that was a lot of fun. I know people that lost power for... But then again, I think Alex up in... He's in Oregon now. He used to be in Seattle. Yeah. He's in Oregon now. I think he lost power for... What, like 5 to 8 days or something? It's a really long time.
Oregon had a pretty similar situation to Texas, just that they're kind of used to it. You know, like winter isn't obscure to them. So it was just the kind of a normal, you know, we've got something going on that has everybody down, takes a couple of days to get out of it. No one in Texas expected this
Spanish
to ever
Inquisition.
Happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for me, it wasn't super bad. We just had rolling blackouts, which, I mean, you say that's not super bad. It could always be worse. The only problem is I had a workshop that I was leading, and I only lead those maybe one a month, but it's a six-hour endeavor. So there was a six-hour window where I had to, like, be constantly talking and demonstrating things to, I think it was like 45 people in that workshop. So... you can't drive around here. Like, we went for walks every night, and it was just, I mean, the roads were like just solid ice, just solid. It was crazy. Like, the likes of which I've never seen, down here in this area, at least. So it was kind of whatever you have on hand is what you're working with at the time. So I had some 5-volt USB booster packs, you know, you like plug your cell phone in to charge them or whatever. And I have some boost converters from other projects. You know, it's like whenever you order something off of AliExpress, for the price of one here, you get 10 from there. So, you know, I just had a bunch of those. So I boosted up 5 volts to 12 volts, and I ran my cable modem, and I ran my home router off of it there, and I had my laptop. And then, you know, I was just at the disco, so every so often my lights would go off, and then every so often they'd come back on, and then they'd go off, and they'd come back on. But it was a lot of fun. It was interesting. It made things exciting. What's interesting is I have like kind of monster cell phone battery booster pack. I got it from when I used to make light suits to run those off of. And so it ran those routers for the 6-hour class, and it still had probably about 2 hours of power left. So it totally made it all the way through. But that was me during that. I had people that sort of near me that lost water too, right? Like pipes freezing. So we're just not, man, we're just not designed for that over here. So that was trying for a lot of folks. And I have some friends that live near hospitals and they had no problems whatsoever. So if you were near some life safety facility, you actually didn't lose power. So I have disowned all of them and they no longer speak to me. But no, it was interesting. You know, it's like I used to thoroughly enjoy snow days. It was, you know, it was just a good time had by all. But then, you know, when your power's fluctuating and you're kind of, you know, your livelihood depends on it, I can see how trying that can be. I know there were a lot of people scrambling to keep up services. So like Grande, my MDU down here in San Marcos, they went down and I called them. And they're like, you're part of the outage. I said, which outage? And they said, the outage. They said, we've got most, all of our major cities in Texas are down right now. And lady on the phone was like, we've lost San Antonio. We've lost Houston. We've lost Austin, Dallas, like just basically everything across the street. So I was like, so is there a masted ticket number or anything that I can reference? She goes, no, it's, we just call it Texas right now.
Good luck. So, hang up.
That was the ticket number. She was just like, it's Texas. So by the next day they had a ticket number actually associated with it, but they had the majority of their fiber services down in the state for like 12 hours. So they never gave me, and you know, I don't really care exactly what the problem was, but I'm assuming it was like long haul relay stations, probably generators running out of fuel or something like that. I mean, I don't know what else to attribute it to. There was a lot of people had a lot of problems here.
Yeah, it's like from up here, it's just like, it's just hard to fathom that like, what do you mean that because there's ice on the road, the data center can't get fuel? Huh? like you mean that Equinix might run out of power? Like the whole facility is going to go dark because they have no more fuel for their generator? Huh?
Well, hopefully they have a contingency plan in place for that. I know the Digital Realty campus in Houston, they used to have a plan that if inclement weather was incoming, like even if it was a few days out, they would order a tanker and they would park it right in front of the generators. And they had a little portal that when the time came, they would just slide open that little portal and run the hose over the generators to fill them up. So it would just sit there. And, you know, they were paying by the day to have that fuel sitting there, not used, mind you, because they never actually really had to use it. But hopefully the data centers would have some facilities in place to do something similar to that.
Yeah, I remember people on Facebook and I think on one of the mailing lists I was on were sharing, like, you know, Equinix was sending out reports fairly regularly when this was first happening. Like, you know, each of their, you know, DA whatever data centers, and then how much fuel each like bank of generators had in terms of hours. And there were some that had 100 and some odd hours, but there were some that were like, there's 26 hours left and we don't know when fuel's coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least the data centers I'm familiar with, they generally have a low mark on the generators, so they will run them and run them and run them. You know, like just because you do generally weekly tests and then you do monthly load tests. And so you'll just let it continue to eat fuel until it drops to that low mark. Then you pull it up to whatever your high mark is. Generally, they don't fill the tanks all the way. So they shoot for X amount of runtime. So if their SLA says they'll have 24 hours of runtime, they'll calculate how much load is currently on the building and they'll fill up the tank just enough to sustain that, right? So, you know, if it only requires half the tank to be full, they don't want to fill up the entire tank because that's additional maintenance they have to do on it. If they have to add stabilizers and stuff, that costs them more, right? And then also they have to buy that fuel. So they don't want to expend, you know, they don't want to have that expense up front to do all that stuff. So it may not, you know, I mean, that tank may be half full, you know, 90% of the time. So, I mean, you never quite know where their levels are going to be at. Yeah, I think every data center probably does it different too, right?
Well, yeah, sure, but like my thing was that like was the fact that like they didn't know if they were going to get fuel,
right?
before they ran out. And so, you know, actually, from what I understand, like, they didn't actually lose power. They were just on, like, a load-shedding agreement where, you know, the, you know, where the power company essentially paid them more than it would cost them to be on generator just to not have, you know, just to free up those, you know, dozens or hundreds of megawatts. And so I think when it got down to 24 hours and they didn't know when fuel was coming, they just said, screw it, we're going back on utility.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, to not know when you're going to get fuel and it's just because there's ice on the road. Like, to someone in the north, it's like, so?
Yeah. Well,
drive. Get in the truck and drive it here.
There's multiple problems you have with that. So, Fibertown used to be part of that ERCOT system, right? So it's like emergency demand. You're exactly right. So what they do is they look at what's your average load that you pull, and then they will pay you based on that every year. Like, they'll just give you cash, right? You know, they just like free money. Why not? The only problem is they test you twice a year and you don't know when it's going to happen. And they'll send you an email alert and then they'll call whatever number you want. And you've got 15 minutes to then shed all of your load until they tell you to come off, right? That's just the test to make sure that you're actually capable of doing that when they require you to do that. And it's for these exact scenarios, right? Like the peak of summer, or in this instance, the peak of winter. If the grid is really hurting, they'll call you, you shed the load. Now, if your tests are successful, then you're hunky-dory. You're going to get your full check. If your test isn't successful, I think you get one failure, you get one retry on that, and then they'll give you like a percentage of what it would have been otherwise, right? So you really want to make sure you do that. And also, if they call you for a real demand like this, you'll still get your money, but if you can't shed the load as long as they want you to, they're going to dock what they're going to pay you. So it's this cat and mouse game. You know, it's like, do I want to deplete my resources? But also, you got to remember that those generators require a lot of maintenance. So you have to look at how many run hours you have on there. How close am I to maintenance? And every hour you're running that generator, you're an hour closer to it failing. So what happens if you actually need that joker to run? You know what I mean? Like, what happens if, you know, this hour, this extra hour you're putting on there to try make extra money is actually the hour you needed it to run when everything failed on you. So it's this interesting cat and mouse, but it is a not insubstantial amount of money. I think it can be, depending on how big you are, like in the hundreds of thousands of dollars that you get paid off of that. So I see why people do it. It's just, it was a really precarious place to be in, because we were doing rolling blackouts just in my area for, I think, 4 days. So to be, you know, running straight for 4 days, that's a lot of load on those generators that aren't really accustomed to doing that. So, I'm glad I'm not in the data center business anymore. That's all I know.
You know, I had heard of, more than one time when there was, you know, some carrier's amplifier site, they just couldn't get fuel to it. So off it goes.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you have fuel, the drivers around here aren't accustomed to driving in that kind of, I mean, they're basically driving a bomb around and they're not used to driving it on ice. So I could see why some sites wouldn't get fuel.
Some of the Texas connectivity issues were, because their amplifier site ran out of fuel and people couldn't get fuel to it, so they just, down it goes.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the state, it wasn't even rolling blackouts. It was just out. Like my mom in Waco, she was down for 4 days straight, I think. And then some people in Belmede were down for like 3 days. In Axtell and north of Waco, they were down for like 5 days. I think it got down to like 24 degrees in their house or something. They ended up rigging up an old generator to some space heaters to get themselves going. I think, what was it? They said they were running the space heater, the television and one light bulb. That's what it could handle. And then if they needed to run the microwave, they would unplug the space heater and run that. They wouldn't unplug the TV and unplug the space heater and run the mic. So I guess you see the order of importance on things there.
Yet, well, and I'm sure there's, you know, some load concerns. You know, your TV uses what, you know, I don't know, 20 watts of power, 50 watts of power, whereas microwave or a space heater is probably going to use 1,000.
Yeah, for sure.
And like, you know, power outages happen up here, but we have generators and we're used to it. And, you know, and there's no concern about, well, if we're out of fuel, how do you get it? Well, you just get it, you know. But, you know, kind of one of my, so like a lot of people love natural gas generators because they don't have those sorts of maintenance requirements on the fuel or fuel storage or making sure that you have enough fuel there for the runtime. It's just natural gas will always be there. And Texas saw that that's not always the case. Sometimes you don't have natural gas available. I guess AT&T had that problem in Nashville too. It wasn't that they didn't have the generator stopped working. It was the natural gas supply for the generator was shut off. So it's one of those things where it's like, you know, you got to keep that in mind, you know, if your backup, you know, generator for the power grid relies on a different grid that also fails, you don't have a backup.
Yeah.
So, you know,
it's how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go? You know, like as far as redundancy goes, and we played those games all the time in the data center businesses. You know, it's, at some point, you're going to gamble somewhere, right? You just hope that you gamble right. So that's what I learned from being in the data center business. You're gambling somewhere because you can't make everything completely, absolutely redundant. So there's some amount of chicanery going on around there. But the house usually wins, so, you know, it's worth going into a data center.
Into not stray into the political aspects of the outage, but I guess more so on the technical ones. It seemed as though that Texas was really banking on natural gas based generation, and they kind of forgot that people also use natural gas to heat their homes, so when it's really cold there's not as much natural gas available. And it was something ridiculous, like 50% of the power generation was from natural gas.
Something like every 10 years we have some kind of abnormal cold weather action here in Texas, and every 10 years the same thing happens, and they put a committee together and they do their findings and they say, we need to do these things. And then they don't do them. And then 10 years later, the exact same thing happens. They put a committee together and they find the exact same problems and they never fix them. So, you know, we're obviously not motivated to fix whatever this is. We're good with just kicking it down the road for 10 more years. So I'm not overly concerned either. I guess there's nothing I can do to impact that.
I guess that aspect is politics, because by the time there's someone who's in charge of making the committee or report or whatever and comes out with it, by the time the next one comes around, they're gone, so they're not getting the heat for it. It's the new guy who can say, well, I wasn't here then. What do you want me to do about it? It seems like there's certainly... if there's the political will within Texas remains to be seen, but it looks like there's a need to diversify the power generation a bit.
When you said political about it, I thought you were going to make a Ted Cruz going to Cancun joke. But that's where that was going.
Oh, it was his daughter's idea. Like, he didn't even want to go.
Had nothing. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're just trying to keep your family healthy and happy. in these trains. No, just the memes were amazing down here. Like, there's just so many good ones. Such a blast. There was one where it was showing him side profile, and he was like going in somewhere, and he had like this horrible mullet going. I don't know why he had his hair like that. And this guy said, what did he say? This Senate in the front and Cancun in the rear haircut is is not even his top three mistakes of this month. It's pretty hilarious. The memes were amazing. So if nothing else, we got comedy out of it. Comedy gold.
But
it's a distant memory now, so I feel better.
Where I was going with that kind of stuff was, you know, lots of people blaming it on, you know, Texas's desire to not be subject to federal regulation and therefore has as minimal inner ties with other grids as possible, so that way they don't have to do all the other stuff. Which I don't know, because it sounds like they're doing rolling blackouts in Oklahoma as well. So it wasn't just Texas that was having the problem. So if your backup, you know, grid power comes from another area that also has rolling blackouts, I don't know what it does for you. But where I was going with that though was with on the generation side, they only have, or you know, you only have two nuclear plants, and one of them was offline for maintenance at the time this happened. And like, I guess in Illinois, that's kind of our 50%, you know, of our power comes from nuclear plants. So I guess we could use some diversification, but in the other way, you guys could probably use another four or five, you know, nuke plants screwing about the state.
Sure. Just keep them away from the hurricanes and the tornadoes. We'll be fine.
With Texas as big as it is, it's probably not too hard to find places to put them.
There's going
to
be some places that are probably not too bad. Yeah, for sure.
If you would have said that same thing 10 years ago, they would have laughed at, I mean, people still do, but I think there's two or three nuclear plants in the U.S. under construction right now. So we're finally getting back over that fear of them and, putting some new stuff out there.
That's good.
And, but will Texas do something that's not fossil fuel based? Probably not.
Survey says, show me potato salad. Who knows what's going to end up happening, man. All right. You guys ready to shift gears? I want to put that long behind me. Old news. Fake news
so
never happened.
On that note, each show I will spend the afternoon before we record looking for any possible new snowpocalypse Texas grid related news, and we'll talk about it every time.
Dude, I was very upset at the time. I was not happy. I mean, we got it done. We made it happen. But my kids had a blast. They got the whole week out of school, and they told them that they don't have to make up that week. So, yeah, they were stoked. The unfortunate part is my kids are stupid, and, they didn't use that time to make up homework that they were missing. So we're still behind the eight ball and all that. I digress. Let's move on to some more technical stuff. I am refreshing my very first LinkedIn Learning course. It's the Network Foundation CLI and Protocols. And so I wanted to put it out to you guys. Is there anything I need to add to this? It covers kind of protocol basics, connection-oriented versus connectionless, right? UDP, TCP talks about. I mean, but this is like the basic of the basic stuff. It talks about ARP and inverse ARP and using IPv6, ICMP, but it doesn't like go down into the minutiae of things. It's really just introducing the concepts to folks and stuff like that. But on the protocols, I thought this is the one that could probably use some spiffing up. So you've got like ICMP, IGMP, DNS, HTTP, HTTPS, POP, IMAP, SMTP, SIP, you know, like some MGCP, some VoIP stuff in there, FTP, TFTP, SFTP, SMB for file sharing, SSH, RDP, SNMP, DHCP, IP config commands, and then, you know, the IP command in Linux, I guess, is kind of taken. It looks like ifconfig is kind of being deprecated in favor of the IP command on most stuff. Does that seem accurate?
I think
the people that kind of maintain these Linux projects, they wait until you really know how to use a command, and then they deprecate it for something else.
Oh, to keep you on your toes. That's why.
I don't know how many times I finally figured out, okay, this is exactly how you do this, and then you know the next version of CentOS or Debian, whatever, it's like, okay, that command's gone. It's not even like you can install the package. Like, the package is gone.
Yeah.
So
on machines, as far as like utilities go, it's going to be like ipconfig, the IP command in Linux, like ipaddr or whatever. You're going to do pings, trace routes, stuff like that. You're going to look at the ARP entries. Maybe use telnet to check a port, like a TCP port. And then use the netstat tool, right, to see if something's like listening or whatever. Do you think of any, or can you think of, or any listeners, can you think of any protocols that are worth mentioning, beyond that stuff? Like the old course was based on a Windows certification test. So it was very Windows centric. So it had like MBT stat, and like NetBIOS stuff in there. And I stripped that out because I don't think too many people mess with that these days.
No, I can't imagine. I don't even know when I last did anything like that. Like, pretty much, didn't Active Directory get rid of the need for NetBIOS?
There were apparently some legacy applications that could still theoretically use it. But, I mean, in all actuality, unless you're probably in the government, doing the nuclear missiles via, like, 8-inch floppies, you're probably good with not having any of that or knowing any of that. I didn't know how far down the rabbit hole to go with some of that stuff either.
And like on the network protocol side, like the only new stuff I can really think of are things that I don't really know enough about, so therefore they can't be that widely used. And like, segment routing, like it's...
Oh, but yeah, but like, that's so above like somebody who doesn't know anything about, like in DNS, I updated it to do the DOE, like DNS over HTTPS, that like browsers start to use. I guess that's kind of a new thing that people might run in. I tried to like find little things like that, but I don't know. It's like, what's something very basic that you would want somebody to know, like as far as network goes? And then troubleshooting, I was thinking, what is the most basic people are going to think they're going to do? Like, look at an IP address, figure out what the subnet mask is, ping stuff. Right, do trace routes, just look at the ARP table. Can you see the neighbor's ARP entry? Just like the most basic of basic things. This isn't supposed to be the end all be all or advanced. It's really just introduction of, hey, I'm somebody who doesn't know anything. So if you think there's like a killer utility that somebody absolutely has to know for that outside of like ping or trace route or the ARP command or, like, basically looking at the IP address. That's what I'm curious if people would add anything to that list. And you guys are people, so if you can't think of anything.
That's the nicest thing someone's ever said about me. I am a person.
You're a people.
Yeah.
As far as I know, I mean, I'm not going to go too far with that.
Yet, boy, all right.
Just marinate on it. You don't have to answer it. Just think about it.
I guess one thing that's kind of new that people should probably be, it's enough of a break, but you also get it a bunch, would be HTTP2, because it's not TCP based anymore. It's UDP based, and Google and Facebook and a bunch of others are using it, and so it's something you're gonna find, and it's enough of a break from traditional.
All right. I'll put a little section on it then.
But it's all a thought I can put into it. I can't think of anything else.
Rock and roll. Because, it's like you want it to be somewhat future-proofed. I don't want it to seem too stale. Although a lot of, you know, I mean, it's like this stuff hasn't changed for 20 years or 30 years or whatever it happens to be. So, you know, the information is still good. It just needs a new coat of paint, I guess, on it.
Yeah. Like, it's not like in my CCNA course, like we didn't even go over OSPF. Like that's how old the course was when I took it. It's just like, Jesus, it's like, teach me something that I can use.
Yeah, I think it was in the CCNA stuff. I think they pulled it back out on the new revisions, though.
Yeah. Like, I think the class, or like the, like, you know, like the, you know, the version after mine, they added it in for the first time. It was like, so I get to learn a bunch of crap that I'm never going to use.
Hmm. How fun.
Which right, is, we... And I haven't used RIP or EI grip or any of those things that Cisco taught you. Like, I haven't used any of them.
Yeah. I didn't run into too many people running EI GRP either. I knew one CCIE who said that he could get route reconvergent so much faster using EIGRP over OSPF, but I never bothered. I always just stuck with OSPF. So it was kind of the one universal we used across everything. So it was easier for people, you know, if they know and understand this thing, then they can apply those concepts everywhere. So it made it a little bit simpler for us. And I would wager that would be for a lot of folks as well. All right, you guys ready to hear about my demo to win experience?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm excited to hear about it.
All right, rock and roll. So this was actually somewhat interesting. I got signed up for it. I have no idea who in the company signed me up for it, but I got signed up for it. So the to win is like a company that does like business training or whatever. And so one of the things they do is demo to win, which is to teach people who are giving technical presentations like sales engineers or something like that. Generally, probably people mostly demoing software, but it could be, you know, systems of various kinds. Anyway, it's how to do technical presentations better. And there were actually a couple of nuggets in there that I thought were interesting. So I thought I would distill that down and share some of my notes with you guys. So maybe you can do your presentations better. I have to say that obviously not all of the class is, you know, represented here. There's actually live portions. So they give you this online video training that they say should take you about a week and a half if you do about an hour of it every day. I put it on 2x speed, which was actually perfect because they talk really slow in the presentations, and I powered through it in about 2 hours. So I did all of the training like in a very short compressed time frame, and then I didn't do the live portion for a while, so I had forgotten everything by the time I'd gotten there. So that was maybe not ideal. But then the live portion, they schedule it for 2 days. It's 3.5 hours, and you really just, you prepare your presentation and you give it. They give you critiques, then the next person goes, critiques, next person goes, right? And if they had already critiqued you on one thing, they don't go in depth, right? So you do get some live back and forth. So it is good to do the class, right? A lot of this stuff, we just try and grab the documentation. But when you have an actual human looking at you, evaluating you, you know, because it's not always you're doing this thing wrong. Sometimes it's you're doing this thing right. You need to do more of that. You know what I mean? So it's not always just course correction in there. So one of the things I distilled down is they talked about the parts of the human brain, which, you know, I'm always interested in that stuff. And they talked about the reptilian, the limbic, and the neocortex. And so they said the reptilian brain is like your fight or flight part of your brain. And they said while it does catch people's attention to use shocking or scary things, they said you don't want to really use that or use that very sparingly, because that could be like if there's too much change associated with something that scares people, and, you know, it might like trigger fear of losing their job or something like that, right? Like, oh, I'm never going to be able to do this. So you probably want to steer away from that, right? So if it's you know, if you're saying things in such a way that like you're gonna have to reevaluate how you're doing everything, it's probably not the way you want to go about it, because that can scare people. Then they were talking about the limbic portion, which is the part of your brain that responds to videos, pictures, and music. And so they said, if in your presentations, if you have something visual, that it actually helps grabs people attention. But keep in mind that they can only focus on one thing at a time. So if there's like, you put a comic up, what are they doing? They're reading the comic. They're not listening to you. Or if there's like a video or a GIF, they're paying attention to that and not you. So if you do, the one thing they said is like, and I'm not like a guy who puts up comics in presentations, but they said, if you do, read the comic. Otherwise, they're going to ignore you. So you can add the emphasis where you want and kind of tie it into your narrative or whatever. But then they were talking about the neocortex portion of your brain. And they said this helps you remember things via association. You know, like something that they're already familiar with. You can liken what you're talking about to something they're already familiar with. That way it kind of like locks into their brain a little bit better. And for me, that's why I always like using, what do you call that, metaphors? So I have to like break down a concept into something stupid and simple. Like, oh, it's like you're making a corn dog. You know what I mean? It's like, if it makes sense to me in that way, it's like easier for me to kind of understand or whatever. They're also talking about like people you're going to be talking to, right? So you're going to be talking to different personalities. So like an operations person, they're going to be motivated by making their job easier, faster, or more accurate, right? If you save the company money, the operations guy doesn't care about that. That's not, you know, like that's not in his purview. So if you're just speaking to ops people, don't waste your time on that sort of thing, right? It's like, know your audience. So if you're talking to an executive, they're going to be more motivated by you aligning your software with their organizational goals, like where they're trying to move things. And then managers, they're going to be looking more towards productivity and lowering risk, right? So less likely for them to get fired, I would assume, but also make their people more, I mean, all of that makes sense, right? Like you intuitively know that, but sometimes if you look at it logically, like, okay, let me take a look at who I'm fixing to present to. What are their titles? What's important to them, right? That you could kind of tailor it. Or like if there's a specific decision maker, right? If somebody's ultimate, because I've seen different decision makers. Sometimes I've seen it be the manager's in the room, but there's one guy that he really trusts, like an engineer that he genuinely trusts. And this engineer is the one who's going to make the decision on this thing, right? So who do I want to speak more to, right? I want to speak more to that decision maker. So figure out who that is, if you can, and try and speak to them in the way that it makes most sense to them. And then they had this interesting way to demo the software, which was, it makes sense once you think about it, but I hadn't really thought of it in this way. And it kind of all ties together. They call it the tell, show, tell method. So the first thing you do is you, well, the very first thing they want you to do is whenever you're starting your presentation, you know, they want you to do like a little limbic exercise. So they would say, you know, like, tell a little story about, so mine, you know, I'm doing automation. So my thing I picked was like operational efficiency. So my little story was about a company who had a lot of stuff and, you know, how their goals aligned with these people I was talking to. And, you know, they were, you know, trying to do all this crazy stuff. And oh, by the way, they were doing it with a single engineer, right? So it's like, wow, they did all of that with a single person because they used automation. And then at the very end, you bring it home, right? You bookend it by maybe giving a quote from that same customer talking about how it made everything work for them, right? So it's like you kind of start and you stop with a visual thing. But the tell, show, tell comes into play when you're actually doing the demo. So we start the slide deck. And then we move into, we show them sort of like an agenda. Like, what are all the things that we're going to be showing you? We, you know, it's like mass configuration pushing. Then we're going to do firmware updates. And then I'm going to show you how to integrate a secrets engine with your automation, right? Like, blah, blah, blah. So we go to the first one. So I don't just jump to my software. I actually tell them what I'm fixing to show them. So I'll say, okay, with mass configuration push, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you what a playbook is. The couple of commands that are actually in there that are going to be doing the configuration, then I'm going to show you the automation system, how easy it is to add that, and then how you launch it, right? So I tell them ahead of time so that I'm not spending too much time in the software. One of the things that they really tried to impress upon you is that showing them less of your software is actually better. And I had to think about that for a minute. I think that actually makes sense, because if I tell them what they're going to see ahead of time, as I'm walking through the steps, they're ticking it all off really quick. and I'm in the software really fast. And then once I'm done showing them everything in the software, I jump back to my slide deck. I reiterate what they just saw, and then I reveal a benefit. So it'll be like, additional efficiencies, right? Just like a little phrase that'll go with it. So if I show them the software, just the points I want them to see, right? I'm not getting mired down in the minutia. Something they told you is that you're not here to teach them to use the software. You're just here to show them the technical value of it, like how it solves their problems, not how to turn every knob and what every knob does. And the less time you spend in your software or your demonstration, whatever it happens to be, the easier it seems, right? Like if I tell them what I'm fixing to show them, show it to them really quickly. Wow, wasn't that simple? And then I back out to my slide deck. That actually makes you, whatever it is you're showing them, so much simpler. You move through all of your steps, blah, blah, blah. At the very end, you bring all your bullet points back up. You kind of give those overall benefits. Again, talk to them about it. And then you bookend and close it. And so I thought that was actually really interesting. I don't know that I'm going to tie in all of those pieces, but I really kind of like that tell, show, tell formula, because sometimes I find myself being too verbose in those presentations. Like I want them to understand how all of these pieces work, but that's not what they're there for, right? This isn't a workshop where they're trying to actually learn the software. And in those contexts, that does make a lot of sense. Like if I'm leading a workshop that's like 6 hours, I'm teaching you some stuff, bruh. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm here so that you understand and learn. If I'm giving you a technical demonstration on, yes, you can see that it, like a lot of times people will say, we need to see it do X, Y, and Z. If I'm just giving you a technical demonstration showing you that it can do X, Y, and Z, you don't necessarily need or want to know every little knob I had to turn to make that work. You just want to see that it worked, see that once it's actually in production and moving, it's not that hard to use. So that was kind of eye-opening for me. I think I'm going to carry some of this stuff through. I don't know that I'm going to carry all of it, but I think it can be advantageous. I know, Nick, you are a software guy and you've got systems that I'm assuming you demo to people. You feel like that's something that you could utilize in there? Or how have you done it in the past when you're demonstrating stuff to people?
The stuff that I'm currently, small projects that I'm making money on were things that were workflows given by a client. So it was just making it comfortable and simple enough for them to use day to day or similar to something they've already used. But I could see the value in that of like having an objective, showing the objective and be like, hey, wasn't that cool? That's what it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and at the end, after you do the tell, it gives them the option to ask any questions they had, right? So if you didn't go into as much detail or they had any questions burning a hole in their pocket, you give them the opportunity to talk about it. Something else they said is, they said, don't stay on your software, move back to the slides. Because if you stay on the software, they'll be staring at it instead of listening to you. Plus, they might come up with more questions like, what does that thing on the screen do? And it like, you know, it like slows everything down.
Disassociates, you know, from where you're at, I guess.
Yeah. You want to try and keep moving them through the narrative that you're trying to tell them, which I thought was interesting. You know, it's like you're telling them a story and they're along for the journey. If they have any questions, you'll answer them, but you know, keep it moving, keep it light. And really, when I first came in, my boss told me that my number one job is to dream with customers, right? It's to like work with them to figure out where the problem is and how we can fix it or how we can streamline this or that. And to me, this really speaks to that because that's what I'm showing them. You know, I'm showing them this can actually be pretty easy, even though it sounds scary to automate everything. And I think it, when you talk about automation, I think it scares people for a lot of reasons. Right, you get like the old curmudgeon-y network guys like me, and it's like, oh, you mean I got to learn all this crap? It's like, I don't want to do that. You know, that's one thing. Or some people are say, you know, oh, you're just trying to replace me with automation. You know, which, you know, if you don't know what you're doing, maybe that is the case. But in all reality, the automation is only as smart as the people creating it. Right, you still have to know how everything works, and when stuff goes wrong, the automation isn't going to magically get in there and fix it all. You know what I mean? It's like you still have to have engineers that are subject matter experts on whatever it is they're doing. So it's not there to replace you. It's there to make your life better so that things don't break as often and you can sleep at night.
So you can deploy changes while you're sleeping and let it roll back if something goes wrong.
I don't know why you say sleeping. I do that in the middle of the day, bruh.
Well, some things you can't. Like if you got a firmware update, like 50, 60 devices, you might want to do that at like 2 o'clock in the morning, but you might not want to stay up. So you can schedule it. If something goes wrong, you get alerts in the morning and then fix it in the morning.
Oh, yeah. Ansible has the concept of batching, which is really awesome. So you can say, hey, run it against a single device all the way through the automation. If that completes, then run it through on 5 devices. If that completes, all right, now do the remaining 20%. If that completes, then do the remaining 100%. Just do all the rest of them. So you can actually do it in chunks for safety. And you can put rollback in there and all that stuff. So you really could schedule that crap to, or you could just say, do that same iteration, but break my network into, you know, 5 pieces. Do it over 5 nights. Yeah, don't break the network. Holy crap. But no.
So you can't tell it, break my network.
I just like to limit, I call it limiting the blast radius. So I pick, you know, X number of devices, like this chunk, and I'll do that chunk first. But I'll still do it in a batch mode for safety. But in case something weird in there happened and even my my testing afterwards didn't pick it up, it's still only affecting this chunk and I don't have to worry about everything. So
you know, I guess kind of circling back a little bit to your tell, show, tell thing, is that it also, like, it's not really disingenuous, but it also, like, prevents them from seeing, like, you know, it shows them what it could be, not like, you know, here's all the crap it takes to really make it this pretty and fancy. It's like, you know, oh yes, this is nice and fancy, I want that. And you're not lying, because they do want that. They just don't know, you know, this is gonna take you 2 weeks of figuring out all this crap it takes to make this happen.
Well, it's like in my head, I imagine I take them to the sausage factory and I walk them around and I point at stuff. Right? I don't put them on the I don't put them in the training program for 2 weeks and then stick them on the assembly line. Right. So I just show them, like, I'll show them a playbook and say, yep, see these parts, all these constituent parts, this is what's doing it right here. Right. And then I'll say, all right, adding it in right here, it's these parts right here, you know, so that is everything. That's all of the pieces. I'm just not describing in painful detail how you get all of these things together or how you actually have to learn what YAML syntax is, and which, you know, some people are averse to, Mike. But the more DevOps stuff you do, the more you start finding YAML. There's a lot of services that use YAML. So it's...
Unfortunately.
I love it.
I don't like tab delineated stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when it gets really, really gnarly, like huge long files, like some of the Docker environment setups. It's hard to keep track of indentation across like hundreds of lines sometimes.
Yeah, stuff that does like syntax highlight. What is it like? I don't use it, but VS Code Studio, I think, does a good job of showing you all the indentations and helping you keep all that stuff together. And you can also, in VS Code Studio, you can collapse chunks together in your YAML file. So that actually makes it easier. Good times. But that was my experience with the demo to win stuff. I thought it was pretty good. I liked it. I just like performing, so it was an opportunity to do that. So
take it to the sausage factory.
Well, you know, it's like the people say, you don't want to know how the sausage is made, you just want to enjoy it. So I just give them a quick tour of the factory.
And then they can pay for commercial support, and they can get help setting it up.
Yeah, somebody
they just need to know what it can do.
Can help them.
Yeah. No, oh, yeah, not me. There's another guy that'll do that. I'm just showing.
That guy right over there. Yeah. The bait and switch. You just think you're getting the mustache, but you're actually getting somebody else. No, oh, I man. Like it. I like what I really like are use cases. Like I'll hear somebody say, hey, in a week and a half, you're going to be doing a meeting with a customer and they're using this product and they want to see you automate against it. It's like, okay, well, first let me go research so I can figure out what this product is. And you know what I mean? It's like, you know, the starting pistol fires and it's like, oh, let me see if I can figure this out in time. And how far down the rabbit hole do I have to go to actually get the demo working? And I don't know, man, that's like I like the challenge of it. It's fun. And at the end of the day, nobody dies if I screw up. You know what I mean? This is not a production. You know, I was talking to another engineer there that got hired on about the same time I did. Guy way more talented than me. He's like multiple CCIE and all that stuff. And he was like, hey, man, are you getting to work on network stuff? And I go, man, I think only about 40% of my engagements are on network. It's like the rest of it's like security and all this other stuff. And he was like, yeah, like all I'm doing is Linux servers. It's like crazy. But, you know, it's like you take whatever comes at you. I don't remember how we got on the subject, but I was like, yeah, there's some career sales engineers that work here. And it's funny talking to them about their stress level, like the things they are so stressed about. And I was like, dude, that stuff doesn't even register on my radar, like as stress. He's like, I know, it's hilarious. You know what I mean? It's like if you've operated big networks and SLAs and you've got spreadsheets that show how much money you're costing the company for every second of downtime, it's like,
it's the heat.
That is stress, brother. You compare it to like the world I'm in now and it's like, are you, what? Are you kidding me? It's a cakewalk. It's ridiculous. So needless to say, I've officially retired. This is amazing. It's the best thing ever.
I was saying, like, it sounds like you're retired at this point.
I've been tired over and over and over, so I figured I'd just retire. No, it's still fun. It's still challenging. I get flexed in all the ways that are a lot of, you know what I mean? It's because there's still Friday I had to demo a cloud-based system we have for somebody on Monday at 2 p.m. So like just figured it out. And so I was like trying to use the cloud-based system and I tied it in the way I thought it was supposed to be and it wasn't pulling the stuff in from my like Ansible infrastructure. I was like, okay, well maybe I need to upgrade. So I tried to upgrade to the newest package and I was fighting it. It wouldn't take the license file. And then it's like, oh, you're not on RHEL because I was still on CentOS 7 with this old box. Because the old version allowed that and the new version didn't. I was like, okay, great. So now let's spin up a RHEL 8. And okay, let's get this thing in the subscription manager. All right. Now let's get it some repos. Okay, let's assign that stuff. So, you know, it's like figuring all this crap out. And then it's like, okay, now let's back up on that old server, install that same version here, install that, upgrade. Okay, let's try it now. Okay, now let's get a certificate on there. It needs a certificate. Oh, the old way I was doing Let's Encrypt on CentOS 7 doesn't work. Let's do a bunch of Googling. None of that works. Of course not. Why would it? Because the EPL repos are asking for a specific file that doesn't exist in the repos and it's a bug and somebody needs to fix it in the repo, but I can't do that. So then it's, you know, it's just, it's like, holy crap. And then you finally get that working. And then at the end of it, none of that fixed it. It didn't need to be upgraded. It's just a bug with your account in the cloud system and you have to submit a support ticket and wait. And it's just like, holy shit. And then I'm talking to this guy and just before he gets off the phone, he's like, hey, did you know we have a demo account for that cloud system? I was like, what? He goes, yeah, somebody told me about it the other day. Let me find the credentials. And you pop in there and it's got everything you need to just at least like show people all the stuff. I was like, holy shit. Cause I was going to be banging my head against this all weekend trying to free. And it's like, but you know, it's like you still run into stuff where it's like I'm in a time crunch. I got to learn all this stuff really fast. And you go through this series of I feel like I'm, you remember that game Mousetrap? I feel like I'm in that. Right? It's like the boots kick the thing and I'm like running as fast as I can to try and beat this crazy mechanism that I put together. It's nutty. Anyway,
starting to sound less like retirement at this point. Just you're running in the maze trying to find the cheese.
It doesn't happen very often, but it happens sometimes. And that's what keeps it exciting. You know what I mean? It's like but even that amount of stress, like, I was like,
not a big deal.
Yeah. I was like, we'll figure this out.
It's just time.
Yeah, because I know at the end of it, if I can't put it together, I'll just tell them, hey, I'll just talk about it with slides and not demo it. And they'll say, okay. You know, it's like, whatever. It's the best. Oh, my gosh. Life sure has changed for me. And I've been kind of thinking about it more because April 6th is my one-year anniversary. So I'm like a month away from from being there a year. It doesn't seem like it. I think I got in there just after the pandemic really set in. So it's like time is kind of compressed from that point till now. It's all just this weird blur. I'm sure that's happened to a lot of folks though, huh?
Crazy year. That's for sure.
Sure. All right. Well, that's Greg talking for 30 minutes straight. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I don't have anything else on the list unless you guys do.
No, I don't think so. I've been... one thing that... it's not really... something that has happened, but I'm going forward, I'm going to be regularly sharing posts in some of Facebook groups and on our social media about our VPN and JOIP sheet or page, because there's always people in these Facebook groups. I mean, it's every couple days there's somebody saying, you know, my customers can't get to Hulu because it's complaining about a VPN. What do I do? And like, just, you know, like, there's always something else that they post a link to our page saying, hey, go here. And then like, and it's like, it's not even just like, oh, small wisps and stuff. Like, there's one guy who's been, he's been like the chief network architect at Cogent for 20 years. Is one of the guys that's dropping links to our page saying, hey, just, these guys got it figured out. Just go there. But it's just like seeing the same crap over and over. I'm like, I'm just going to start every 2 weeks. Here's the page.
Start spamming them.
It,
well, that works so well for Cogent when they start spamming people asking if they want services.
It's just, you know, try to find new ways of reaching out to people to say, hey, we've already got this solved. Go here. I mean, it's not solved, but, you know, here's the listing of what to go through.
For sure. So we had, I guess before we stick a fork in it, we had talked about after the Sonar, if there were any other vendors people wanted to talk to. And so we had thrown out Splinks, and it looks like Splinks isn't in a place where they want to talk to us just yet. I think they're working on it. But then there's also, I think somebody whipped out Visp, and I think Dennis Burgess graciously offered up to talk to us about tower coverage, so we might get him in there as well. But if you guys, Miller's going to have a contact for Visp. We can hit him up and see get somebody to talk to. But yeah, if there's any other vendors or the like that you guys would be interested in us talking to, especially if you can make a warm introduction, please reach out and let us know about that. All right. So let's stick a fork in it. Mikey from Chicagoland, if folks are going to get a hold of you out on the internet, how would they do that?
Patreon.com/TheBrothersWisp.
Fantastic. All right. Nick Arellano, if people want to see your long, luscious locks, what's the link to your OnlyFans site?
It is the same link that Mike Hammett just gave. Exclusive content. Access to the Slack group.
What were you going to say, Mike?
I shared this I think it was last week or maybe it was the week before, and I think you saw it and made some comment about it. Somebody on Facebook said that they found my business cards, and they had made a business card that just had my name, and then it said something like, leave me alone, or don't contact me, or don't something contact like that. I was like, that's pretty priceless. Much it.
Priceless. Yeah, we'll make it happen. We'll make it happen. All right, so Nick, other than
the Brothers Fist, Little Brothers with fans.
Slack, how else can they get a hold of you? There's an email account, right?
Yeah, nick.a@hey.com.
Hey,
send me a hey.
Excellent. And Nick is a very talented engineer, very good at consulting. I'm not sure how busy he is right now, but you can drop him an email and just say how much you like his beanie beard combo, because it's working. It's working for me anyway. So if you guys want to get a hold of me, I'm greg@gregsoul.com. That's my email address. You can go to gregsoul.com, where I regularly blog. If you want to get immediate access, like in my face, and you want to talk to me, that's patreon.com/littlebrotherswisp. You can join the Little Brothers with Slack and become part of the army. And one last time, because I know he listens all the way to the end, thank you, Ollie, for being the we'll put interim curator until Mike bestows you the official title. And thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah.
Let me click stop on all the things. Come up here. I'll click stop.
Ideas and some good comedy given. If you miss the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.